Welcome to NACE Clinical Highlights. I'm Dr. Greg Sherman, Chief Medical Officer for the National Association for Continuing Education. Joining me today for a discussion on the recognition and management of multiple myeloma is Dr. Lisa Marie Bashir Rodriguez. Dr. Bashir Rodriguez is an attending physician at Montefiore and an assistant professor of medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Her clinical focus is on developing new strategies to minimize toxicities for bone marrow transplant recipients and to improve the way we use novel cellular therapies to treat complex blood malignancies. I'm really excited to spend a few minutes with her to hear her insights on how we can do a better job of recognizing our patients with multiple myeloma and really managing them more appropriately, especially those with earliest evidence of disease. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you for having me, Greg. Nice to be here.
I'm glad you could be here as well. Lisa, you know as well as anybody that our understanding of hematologic malignancies, actually, in fact, all malignancies in general, has progressed so rapidly over the last several years and continues at a very rapid pace. So the evolving data in the care of patients with multiple myeloma suggests that diagnosing these patients even earlier may provide other opportunities for treatment that we never had before. Given the critical role that primary care play in the evaluation of these patients, it's really important to make sure that our primary care colleagues are really up to speed on how to appropriately work up these patients when they suspect it, when to refer, and then when we do refer, how do we co-manage with you, our hematology-oncology partners? I want to let our listeners know that you can access an enduring CME activity on multiple myeloma at our website, naceonline.com, and learn more about what Lisa and I are discussing today. So I was hoping to start off our discussion today by having you sort of remind us of the prevalence of multiple myeloma in our communities and the kinds of patients that we might really heighten our awareness for when we see them.
Of course. So multiple myeloma accounts for about 18% of hematologic or blood cancers in the United States. During the year 2020, about 30,000 new cases will be diagnosed, and unfortunately, over 12,000 men and women will die of myeloma in the U.S. The prevalence is higher in African American and Black African populations, and the median age of diagnosis is 66 years. So unfortunately, African American and patients over the age of 60, we should be having more heightened alertness for these patient populations.
Thanks very much. As I think about multiple myeloma, remembering back to medical school, pathophysiology was confusing then, and it's probably still confusing to many of our colleagues. But I think it's probably even more important now as data is evolving to understand the screening and management process, to understand the pathophysiology. So can you maybe go back a little bit to our teaching days and remind us of what happens in multiple myeloma from sort of the beginning to presentation pathophysiologically?
Of course. So it's a multi-step process. Myeloma being a disease of plasma cells starts in the bone marrow. So I always tell my patients in the bone marrow, we have our blood-forming cells. And one of these cells are called the plasma cells. And these originate from B cells. And through a series of mutations in the DNA of these plasma cells, they evolve from becoming a one cell to rapidly dividing into clonal malignant plasma cells. MGUS, or monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, occurs when these clonal plasma cells are producing an abnormal protein that really then is the cause of multiple problems further down the road. The monoclonal gammopathies exist in a spectrum, again, going from MGUS, which is an asymptomatic condition where one clonal plasma cell produces an abnormal antibody, to smoldering multiple myeloma, which is kind of like an in-between between MGUS and multiple myeloma, in which patients have more of these plasma cells, more abnormal protein in the blood, but they don't necessarily have end organ damage. And finally, when someone has multiple myeloma, these plasma cells are already causing end organ damage, anemia, elevated calcium levels, kidney dysfunction. So it's a process that occurs over time through the development of genetic abnormalities in these plasma cells and the production of an abnormal protein that eventually causes end organ damage.
So Lisa, you mentioned smoldering multiple myeloma. I don't remember back from my training hearing about that. Is that a new development or phrasing of this process, or is based on understanding, or where is that coming from?
So again, over the last 10 or 15 years, we have come to recognize that smoldering multiple myeloma is kind of like a pre-malignant condition. So patients who not yet have evidence of multiple myeloma go through this process of smoldering myeloma where they have the abnormal plasma cells producing an abnormal protein, but they do not yet have the evidence of end organ damage or the classic CRAB criteria like we have learned in medical school. As a reminder, in multiple myeloma, again, patients have to have end organ damage. We learned about the CRAB criteria, which is hypercalcemia, renal failure, anemia, and bone disease. In smoldering myeloma, we're kind of one step before myeloma, where you have an abnormal protein, you have evidence of clonal plasma cells in the bone marrow, but you do not yet have end organ damage.
So how might patients typically present to us in our primary care offices or settings where we're seeing them that should really trigger us to consider screening them? Is it symptoms, lab abnormalities, a combination?
So unfortunately, the majority of patients will be asymptomatic. And then if they do present with symptoms, they're very nonspecific. So patients might express fatigue or tiredness, peripheral neuropathy, but the vast majority of patients are asymptomatic. Where we really catch these patients is by looking at their blood work. So a lot of our patients in primary care, they come to the office, they get blood work for another reason. And if you notice that they have an elevated total protein, but a reversed albumin-globulin ratio, that should prompt the question, where is that extra protein coming from? So we know that the myeloma protein is not an albumin, it's a globulin. Albumin should be about 50% or more of the protein in our blood. So if you see a patient with an elevated total protein and a reversal in the albumin-globulin ratio, it should prompt the question of what is happening, where is that abnormal protein coming from? So yes, elevated protein and a reversal of the albumin-globulin ratio.
So is there any sort of cutoff on elevation in proteins that should trigger further evaluation or any abnormalities above the normal limits?
So I think any abnormality above the normal limits, as a reminder, the total protein in the body is about 6 to 8 grams per deciliter. So anything above 8, I think, should prompt a workup as to where that abnormal protein is coming from. And the albumin-globulin ratio is typically greater than 1. So anything less than 1, 0.9 even, should prompt a further workup looking where the abnormal protein is coming from.
So that brings up another question that I think about in our elderly patients, which often have many abnormalities related to underlying chronic disease, chronic kidney disease, that may have some of these CRAB criteria, may have protein abnormalities. Is there some other triggers in the elderly that have concomitant disease that we should be more particularly aware of?
I think in the elderly, unfortunately, because of these other comorbidities, any elevation in total protein we should be looking at. We know that our patients in the elderly can sometimes have anemia of chronic disease, can sometimes have renal dysfunction related to diabetes or hypertension, and that might confound things. But the key component, I think, is the total protein. These other conditions should not be elevating your total protein. Anemia of chronic disease, renal insufficiency, those, again, can affect your hemoglobin, can affect your creatinine, but should not be affecting the total protein. So if you see the total protein being abnormal, you should send for other blood work.
That really leads us to the next question that I think our colleagues that are listening are going to think about. Okay, I've thought about it. You might have multiple myeloma. Now what do I do about it? I think it's important for us to maybe go through what's an appropriate primary care evaluation, what biomarkers or other testing should we really have in our armamentarium ready to order when we think of it?
Of course. And so like I mentioned, looking at that total protein and the reversal of the albumin-globulin ratio, there's a test that we can send off to identify abnormal proteins, and that's a serum protein electrophoresis with immunofixation. We basically summarize it as an SPEP with an IFE. And what that does is it looks at all the protein in the blood, and it basically runs the protein on a gel, and we can see different patterns for different proteins. And the SPEP and UPEP in the urine, or SPEP and IFE, is going to be the one that allows us to identify the abnormal protein. as a reminder, that abnormal M protein for multiple myeloma is called an M protein. It's seen as an M spike on the protein electrophoresis, and it's nothing more than an abnormal antibody. Antibodies have two regions, a light chain and a heavy chain. So another test that we often send in hematologic malignancies is a free light chain assay. The free light chain assay is going to help us detect an elevated abnormal free light chain from a part of the antibody that's being produced by these abnormal plasma cells. So again, the serum protein electrophoresis and immunofixation will help us identify the M spike, and the serum free light chain will help us identify the excess light chain component of the antibody. Antibodies come in different flavors, what I say to my patients, IgG, IgM, IgA, and the light chains are either going to be kappa or lambda. Other tests that are important in risk stratification of multiple myeloma include a lactate dehydrogenase, or LDH, and a beta-2 microglobulin. These are all blood tests that could easily be sent by a primary care provider. Again, summarizing, the SPEP with the IFE, the serum free light chain assay, a lactate dehydrogenase, and a beta-2 microglobulin to help with risk stratification. In terms of imaging, we can always start with a skeletal survey, which is a very simple x-ray of the whole body that will allow us to see if there's any evidence of bone damage caused by these plasma cells.
That's terrific. But what you didn't really mention, maybe I missed it, was a urine protein electrophoresis. Is that something that's a routine part of your workup, or is that offer minimal additional value given the additional testing that we have?
So back in the day when we did not have the serum free light chain assay, we routinely used to send the urine protein electrophoresis because oftentimes the disease was not detected in the blood, but it was detected in the urine as the proteins were excreted in the urine. So we still send it at the beginning of a diagnosis, the urine protein electrophoresis, but more often than not, we are relying on the serum free light chain assays from the blood.
I want to let our listeners know that you can access an enduring CME activity on multiple myeloma at our website, naceonline.com, and learn more about what Lisa and I are discussing today. You can access this and many other programs we have developed on other topics. You can also register for one or more of the many live conferences we produce every year. If you're on Facebook, please like us and we'll be able to share more educational content and information with you. So Lisa, now that we've learned about the prevalence, which patients to test, how to do our screening, we get some abnormal proteins. How can we understand the difference between MGUS, smoldering multiple myeloma, and multiple myeloma? I think it'd be helpful to really learn about the more specific diagnostic criteria.
Of course. And even for a hematologist oncologist, we sometimes have to go back to the textbook and there's specific cutoffs for values. And so I will be saying different lab values, but it's always important to go back and check the primary reference. So for example, in MGUS and monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, we have the plasma cell making the abnormal protein, but no evidence of end organ damage. And the cutoff here is that the M protein or the M spike is going to be less than 3 grams per deciliter. And if we look at the bone marrow biopsies of these patients, the clonal plasma cells are going to be less than 10%. In the urine, they will have less than 500 milligrams per 24 hours of urine monoclonal protein. In the case of smoldering multiple myeloma, like I mentioned, this is the in-between between MGUS and multiple myeloma. Here, the M protein is going to be more than 3 grams per deciliter. The urine monoclonal protein is going to be greater than 500 milligrams in a 24-hour period, and the clonal bone marrow plasma cells are going to be more than 10%. Patients who have smoldering multiple myeloma, we will often do imaging like the skeletal survey to make sure that they don't have any evidence of bone lesions because, again, they could be on the verge of having multiple myeloma. Multiple myeloma is defined by the CRAB criteria. The CRAB criteria stands for calcium, renal dysfunction, anemia, and bone lesions. The bone marrow biopsies of these patients will often have between 10 and 60% clonal plasma cells. If they have greater than 60% clonal plasma cells, they automatically have multiple myeloma, even if they don't have the CRAB criteria. Another diagnostic feature of multiple myeloma is the level of free light chain that we have in the blood. So if we have a free light chain, either kappa or lambda, of greater than 100 milligrams per liter, and a ratio between the involved and uninvolved chain of greater than 100 milligrams per liter, again, you automatically meet criteria for developing, for having multiple myeloma. The CRAB criteria, again, very specific lab values for calcium greater than 11 milligrams per deciliter, renal insufficiency with a creatinine of greater than 2 milligrams per deciliter, anemia, hemoglobin less than 10 grams per deciliter, and bone lesions defined as greater than one lytic lesion detected via X-ray or a PET CT.
So, as I mentioned in the beginning of this discussion, there are all these studies that I'm aware of have come out and continue just on hematologic malignancies and all malignancies. Multiple myeloma certainly has had its fair share. I think understanding some of the data that's out now and why it's especially important for our colleagues to find these patients and manage them appropriately would be really helpful. Can you tell us a little bit about the emerging data that will impact our primary care colleagues?
Of course. I think one of the most important studies to cite these days is the ECOG EA306 study. This was a study of lenalidomide versus observation in patients with high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma. So what I haven't mentioned is that patients who have smoldering myeloma can be stratified into low, intermediate, or high risk based on several criteria. Patients who meet criteria for high-risk multiple myeloma were included in this study. The study was a multi-center randomized trial. It had about 182 patients. The patients were diagnosed based on the IMWG criteria, the International Myeloma Working Group, and they were risk stratified based on the Mayo 2018 criteria, again, for having low, intermediate, or high risk smoldering myeloma. What they did in this trial is that they gave lenalidomide to all patients, and they saw that lenalidomide improved progression-free survival in all cohorts, but especially in the patients who had high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma. So what does that mean? What that means is that there is actually a drug that's already been approved, lenalidomide, for the treatment of patients with multiple myeloma. And if we give this drug to patients who have smoldering myeloma, we can delay the progression to multiple myeloma. Quality of life was also impacted in this study, possibly because the patients, by delaying the progression to multiple myeloma, had less of the side effects of having multiple myeloma. There's been other studies looking at different therapies in smoldering multiple myeloma, including the use of an antibody called daratumumab or Darcelex. These have shown very promising results. There is also data to suggest that by treating patients with smoldering myeloma aggressively with what we call triple therapy or these cure trials, we might actually be able to cure smoldering myeloma before it even becomes multiple myeloma. So again, a lot of very interesting data coming out there about identifying patients who have smoldering myeloma before they have myeloma, treating them, potentially curing them, or at very minimum, delaying the progression to having multiple myeloma. Again, lenalidomide being one of those most promising drugs that have shown that if we give it to patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma, we will delay progression to the actual blood cancer myeloma.
I think that is fascinating and really amazing data and clearly changes the way that we address these patients. The question that comes to mind is really twofold then. I don't think we really discussed yet how long it might take for someone that gets diagnosed with MGUS to progress to multiple myeloma. And based on sort of that information, what do you think is the appropriate role for our primary care colleagues once they find a patient with MGUS, assuming that's where we're picking the majority of them up? Are we seeing them and monitoring them, referring them? Please give us some guidance on those things.
Okay, so I think here the importance is to try to determine if the patient has MGUS or smoldering myeloma based on the criteria that I mentioned previously about the level of M protein that they have and the bone marrow involvement. MGUS actually has a progression to myeloma of 1% per year. Typically, these patients get referred to a hematologist oncologist once they make the diagnosis of MGUS, and we monitor them getting blood work about every 3 to 4 months for the first year. Then we space it out to every 6 months and then just once a year. Patients with MGUS can be referred to the hematologist oncologist, but we'll usually follow them probably just once a year. Smoldering multiple myeloma is a little bit different because the progression to multiple myeloma depends on where you fall on the risk stratification. Are you low, intermediate, or high? We know that the median time to progression of someone with low risk smoldering multiple myeloma is about 110 months. Intermediate risk is about 68 months, and high risk is 29 months. So all the intermediate and high-risk smoldering myeloma patients should definitely be seen a hematologist-oncologist more frequently. Low-risk can potentially still be followed by their primary care provider. In these patients with smoldering myeloma, we will typically monitor their blood work every 2 to 3 months for the first several months, and then again space out their blood work if we see that it's remained stable. So again, MGUS initially can be checked every 3 to 4 months, then every 6 months, then once a year. Smoldering multiple myeloma, we want to be checking more frequently, initially every 2 to 3 months, then every 3 to 4, and then finally every 6 months at minimum. If they progress to high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma, they should definitely be seen by a hematologist-oncologist for consideration of these drugs like lenalidomide.
So it sounds like for our primary care colleagues that are managing these patients that maybe have MGUS and they're following after a period of time where you've assessed that it's stable, we should be checking the proteins once a year.
Correct.
Not more frequently than that. And then if they progress, we should certainly have them see our hematology oncology colleagues more frequently. What else are we doing in the process when they are being managed by the hematologist and oncologist?
So the hematologist-oncologist is going to be the one doing more ancillary tests like bone marrow biopsies. But as a primary care provider, I think it is important to be checking all the basic lab work just to see whether or not they have evidence of CRAB criteria. So looking at their complete blood counts, seeing whether or not they have anemia, looking at a complete metabolic panel or complete chemistry with liver function tests to see whether or not they have elevated calcium or renal failure. These are all things that the primary care provider can do. For patients who have MGUS, for example, or even low-risk smoldering myeloma, getting a skeletal survey at least once a year is sufficient. Again, patients who have high-risk smoldering myeloma should be monitored more frequently with the same blood work and also imaging.
I think that's terrific. And I think that's really the critical part of it. What I find exciting about this is there's new data and new options that really can change the course of the disease. And even if our colleagues are not doing the actual monitoring and the serum protein electrophoresis, that they are aware that picking up changes in CRAB criteria can really have significant impacts on where that patient gets treated. So I think that's really critical to know. So thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
Lisa, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me and sharing your expertise on how we can do a better job of screening and managing our patients, not only with MGUS, but really also multiple myeloma. I think the information you provided on how we can improve the care we provide our patients will really make a significant difference in their lives. So thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Greg. Thank you for having me.
If you're interested in learning more about multiple myeloma, go to our website at naceonline.com and register for our enduring activities on multiple myeloma or any other program we've developed. Please like us on Facebook at NACME to be part of our online social media community and get access to other content and programs that we share. I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this podcast. I hope you've learned something new you can bring back to your practice. We look forward to having you join us for other upcoming podcasts in the very near future.